Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I am Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the great engineer and mixer, Elliot Shiner. But first, let's talk about Jay-Z and his new streaming network, which is called Tidal. Now, if you've been following anything that I write on Forbes or on my Music 3.0 blog, you know that Tidal has been something that we talked about an awful lot because it's very interesting, and in many ways it may set the bar and force the industry to go in a high-def direction. And that's pretty cool, actually, because Tidal gives you CD-quality streaming, which you can't get anywhere else. You can get high-def streaming, but you can't get it at CD quality, and that's pretty cool. So anyway, Jay-Z had a big press conference for the relaunching of Tidal, and he had all these superstar artists, which he called early investors, like Madonna and Taylor Swift, Nicki Minaj, Rihanna, Coldplay, Jason Aldean. In all, there were 12 of them. And once again, he called these his early investors, and they made a really big deal about how this was going to be brand new for the music business, and it was going to be artist-owned. But the only problem with this is it looks like it benefits only the people that are the 1% of the music business. So, in other words, these superstars may actually get a piece of the company, but what does that do for everybody else, especially the end user? What does it do if you're a Tidal user? What makes you want to spend the $9.95 or the $19.95, the high-def tier? What makes you want to actually go there, spend that kind of money, especially spend $10 a month more than you're used to paying, and actually you're used to paying probably nothing because you're on the free tier of Pandora or Spotify or RDO or any other number of streaming networks. So this is really interesting. It seems like it was sort of a good idea that had a half-baked press conference, one that maybe they rushed out a little bit too early because, again, how does the end user benefit? And how do regular artists benefit? Now, they've since come out and they've said, okay, the way this works is you're going to be paid, you, the artist, will be paid multiples higher than from Spotify. But they didn't say exactly what that was, and they didn't say exactly how that worked. The other thing that's a problem with that is the fact that most artists that are hit artists have a deal with the record label, and the record label actually gets paid the bulk of that. So it doesn't, in the end, really help the artist unless there's a direct deal done, which, of course, if you have a record deal, that's not going to happen. The other thing that's not really clear is, do you get paid more if someone subscribes to the $19.95 tier? So one of the things they said that would be an enticement for end users is there'll be exclusive material that you can't get anywhere else, which may or may not work. For the most part, lots of exclusive material on other things like DVD audio discs or even DVDs, the extra material, that's one of those things that you watch or listen to once and you never go back to. So it's not that much of an enticement. That being said, it's really interesting that, in fact, all these artists have got together, and it's interesting that they're investors and there's going to be a second tier, of course. But how this actually works in the modern age, the modern streaming age that we live in, is yet to be determined. So this will be interesting to keep up on. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching course. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Now let's talk about something that's kind of the cutting edge of audio. It's the AES 3D audio standard. Now, if you don't know anything about 3D audio, first of all, this is a part of the virtual reality headsets that you're seeing. So, for instance, Oculus Rift, or the Microsoft HoloLens, or the Sony Project Morpheus, or even smartphones or tablets or anything that employs a headphone system, pretty soon is going to be going to binaural audio or 2D to 3D audio. Which is very interesting because now suddenly this way of recording and listening to audio, which has been around for a long, long time, suddenly back to the future, so to speak. And now it's the hot thing. The only problem is that everybody had their own way of interpreting binaural audio data. So it was very difficult for developers to actually share that data. And this data is called HRTF, or head-related transfer function data. And it's basically the numbers that interpret binaural data. So anyway, if you don't have a standard put together for this, then it's really difficult to exchange those algorithms. And that's what the AES has attempted to do, and they have a new standard that they call AES69-215. What this does, it enables developers, audio developers, and virtual reality headset developers to exchange this data very easily. So what AES69-2015 does is it supports a description of the HRTF measurement setup. So in other words, where are the microphones placed? It has consistent definitions of metadata, and right now everybody calls things a little bit differently, which again is very hard to interpret. And finally, it gives the ability to describe multiple conditions, like how many listeners were in the room and the distances between microphones and the source, which once again, that wasn't standardized. So this is kind of interesting because now it will enable 3D audio to expand. It's a really good thing that this happened. And I think you're going to see 3D audio as the coming new thing. So keep that in mind. 3D audio is a very interesting new development. So now for my guest. I'm really happy to have Elliot Shiner on today. Elliot's one of the best known and most indie man mixers ever. He's been nominated for 25 Grammys and he's won 8, as well as 2 Emmy Awards. Elliot has mixed so many superstar acts like the Eagles, Steely Dan, Sting, Eric Clapton, Jackson Browne, Fleetwood Mac, and so many others. I spoke with Elliot via Skype from his home in Connecticut. Elliot, thanks for being with me today.
Happy to be here.
Tell me, what was it like to have Phil Ramone as a mentor?
Well, I didn't know any other mentors, really. No, actually, I did, but... You know, Phil, you know, soon after I started working for Phil, I mean, I knew I would gain a lot of knowledge. You know, there was no other way. There were no schools. You learned from the engineers that were working at a studio if you were lucky enough to get a job at a studio. So the more I worked for Phil and I looked around and saw the other studios and really didn't see any studio in New York that had anything close to what Phil or A&R had. And, you know, at times it was, you know, at times I'd worry whether I was doing enough, whether, you know, Phil would approve of what I was doing, because he pretty much, you know, when I was his assistant, you know, he pretty much gave you full control of, you know, the way you saw a room set up. So, you know, I have a date with him, you know, let's say from 10 in the morning till 6 at night, and it might be a big band or an orchestra or something. And he wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't comment beforehand, you know, unless there was something so weird. You know, he just let you set the room the way you thought it would work. And if it didn't work, you know, he'd let you have it, I guess, in the morning. But, you know, so I always wondered what, you know, I'd start to second guess myself, and I go to other guys and question, you know, am I doing the right thing here? But there was no better teacher. Now, the other engineers at A&R at the time, were, you know, I gained a lot from them as well. It's just that I worked more with Phil than any of the other guys. So, you know, it was quite a learning experience for me, you know, and it's something that I was always forever grateful to Phil for.
Was Phil producing at the time, or was he just engineering?
He was just engineering.
And that must have been interesting to see him make that transition.
Well, by the time he made the transition, I wasn't working for him anymore. You know, I mean, generally the way it worked at A&R, you know, you were hired as what they call them, setup men. You know, but you were an assistant engineer, basically. You were a tape op and you set up the room and broke down the room and did anything, you know, the engineer needed. So by the time, I mean, I was literally engineering within the first 6 to 9 months. You know, Phil would just sort of throw you into it. And, you know, you went through a process. You learned how to cut a ref disc. You learned how to edit film a little bit and edit mag stripe and full coat. But generally, right after that, you know, he'd you know, he'd bring you back to, in my case, I worked for him again after that. And, you know, he just threw me from the frying pan into the fire.
So you were cutting discs back then? I didn't realize that. Yeah.
You gotta remember back then, you know, most people didn't have the ability to play a tape copy, you know, because that's what there was. It was either tape copies or rep discs. So 9 out of 10 times, you know, you'd have a rep disc cut. Now, there were guys who were actually doing it all the time, you know, cutting a disc, but you had to learn how. But you might finish a date late at night after midnight or something, and the artist would want to take a rep disc back home. So you'd have to go down and cut it.
Did you feel that that helped you in engineering?
Well, I was awful. I mean, I couldn't cut a good rep disc at all. So it didn't help me at all. I couldn't get out of the mastering room fast enough.
Because, you know, it's interesting talking to Ken Scott and he describing the Abbey Road way, where before you became an engineer, you went to mastering and you learned everything about mastering, and they felt that was the best way to, once you understood the limitations of final, then you'd be a better engineer.
Who's this?
Well, this is Ken Scott, and this is Abbey Road. This is the Abbey Road apprentice method, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't know that existed where I was, and there was never any talk about that. I mean, that could be the only benefit you got from knowing what you could and couldn't get on a disc. But, you know, I mean, if you had to cut a good disc to understand how to engineer, that didn't work for me.
Because
I could never. But, you know, I knew that, you know, if I was mixing a cut that I knew was going to be in the inner band, you know, not to put much bass on it.
Right.
So, I mean, there were those kind of, that was that knowledge. But, you know, other than that, no, I didn't, you know, I mean, if it is, I mean, there are guys doing work today that's phenomenal, and they never cut a disc in their lives.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. How did you, when you started, was it 4-track or was it 8-track?
It was 4-track. Well, no, wait a second. It was 4. I mean, 4-track, in one of the rooms, it was strictly 4-track. In the other room, it was 8-track. So, but 8-track had just literally, you know, I think the machine was delivered about 2 weeks before I got there. And I remember all the engineers at the time were saying, well, what do we do with all these tracks? You know, I mean, typically on a 4-track, they would, you know, put the entire rhythm section on 1 track, and then they put like strings and horns if there were on another, and then vocals on the last two.
Well, when did it occur to people to split things up?
Soon after the 8-track came in, somebody said, well, why don't we put the drums separately? You know, just put all the drums on 1 track and then we have control of that. And the bass went on a separate track. So there was that kind of utilization. And, you know, it really depended on what you were recording. But at times you'd have the piano separate or guitar separate. But, you know, you'd still end up putting all the strings on 1 track, all the horns on 1 track. So, I mean, it varied, you know, and it was, you know, by the time 16-track rolled around, you know, going, oh, man, you can keep the kick separate. You can keep the tom separate or the snare separate, you know. So it was good in that we grew with the technology. It wasn't like, you know, some of the kids that come in today, they got to jump into everything all at once. Yeah. Whereas, you know, I just, you know, 4-track primarily and a little bit of 8-track. And then as it grew, I grew.
When did you see stereo recording started, like spreading the drums out and the piano and things like that?
Well, the only thing I really ever recorded in those days that was stereo was a piano. And occasionally, I mean, maybe a string section, you know, just take a couple of M50s and place them up high and hope that, you know, they'd play well. But I didn't do much in the way of stereo drums except for overheads. Well, I guess, you know, it depends. I mean, I would, you know, if there were three or four times back then, you know, I would put it on a stereo track. But as far as guitars and most keyboards, you know, everything was generally mono, and I preferred it to be mono.
Yeah. But when did you see the transition to more stereo happening? Was that in the 70s, the late 70s? Or was it when there were more tracks with 16 track, for instance?
Even then, you know, no, it was more, when I really noticed it was when digital keyboards came in, which would be the late 70s.
Yeah.
You know, it was a primary example. That was like the first Yamaha, Yamaha stereo keyboard that I remember.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything started being stereo because it had two outputs. You know, and a lot of times you would get information that was stereo, you know, it said stereo, but it was really mono.
Yeah, right. When did you feel like you had a good handle on mixing? I mean, did it take a while for you to feel like, okay, I got this, or were you comfortable right from the beginning?
No, I wasn't comfortable from the beginning. A great example. I recorded Van Morrison's Moondance, and it was late fall. We've been working on it for a while, but it was in the late fall, closer to Christmas. I got word from the label and from management that it had to be mixed and submitted by January 1st. And Van didn't want to come down. He wanted to be with his family. And so he stayed up there all Christmas, and this was only 8-track, and I was uncomfortable with it. You know, I was just uncomfortable on a music level. You know, I didn't feel comfortable that I would get this right by myself. So I had Van's drummer, Gary Malabar, you know, come in and sit with me, and, you know, I mixed it with him there. And, you know, any musical decisions, you know, I sort of deferred to him. Sonically, he deferred to me. So after that point, I mean, it wasn't a huge record, but it was a seminal record, and it did okay. And after that point, I felt more comfortable. But everything's cyclical. I mean, you know, you have a bunch of hits, and then all of a sudden you don't have any hits, and you wonder it's because you're not doing a good job mixing, or, you know, so I don't know if you ever feel comfortable. At this point in my career, I'm totally comfortable. You know, I accept what I do, and if people are calling me, they're calling me because they want me to do what I do. So, you know, at this point, I'm totally okay.
You once told me that, unlike a lot of other engineers, you don't editorialize when you're mixing, and if there's 100 tracks, you find a way to fit all of them in. How do you do that? I mean, with more, the track counts are going up, and they certainly, from what I see, they're not coming down. So how do you do that?
Just, you know, it's balancing. It's, you know, I focus on each instrument. I don't ever, and I've seen a lot of guys do this, and I'm not capable of doing it this way, but I've seen a lot of guys just throw up the faders and start balancing and, you know, get a vibe to it. And, you know, if you don't hear anything, everything, you don't, you know, as long as you've got some kind of vibe going and it feels good and it sounds good, you know, so maybe you won't hear everything. For me, it's an individual focus. So like if I start a mix, I'm starting with the drums, and I get that to a point where, you know, I like what they sound like and I like the balance, and I see where they're sitting, and I'm always going to hear them there. So anything I put in afterwards, like I'll put the bass in next, and usually I concentrate on the kick when I'm putting the bass in. You know, the bass is never louder than the kick. The kick is never louder than the bass. You know, it's something to me that has to be equal. And based on where I put the kick in the kit, you know, I'm gonna hear everything I want to hear. And it's like that. It's constant, you know. So for the next thing I put in, I'm balancing it against those two things. you know, and I'm making sure that I hear what I'm putting in plus everything I've put in prior to it. And it's just a sense of building it. And that's generally how I, you know, how I think about a mix. You know, I want to hear everything. I mean, I take it for granted that an artist or a producer put this in a record because they wanted to hear it. Yeah. So I just assume, you know, I'm going to make them hear it.
What's the typical track count you're getting these days?
It varies. You know, I just, you know, it's sometimes it's 48. Sometimes it's a little less than that. And sometimes it's, you know, between 100 and 150.
Crazy, huh?
Yeah, it's crazy in a sense, but when you look at it, you know, when I load it in and I look at it on the screen, you know, some guys, when they record, like they'll put a couple of background parts on two channels and then another background part, same singers, different kind of part in a different place on two other tracks when they could have been on the same tracks. You know, so a lot of times I'll get the track count down by just, you know, busting them out of the same outputs.
Yeah, yeah. Are you still using Nuendo?
Yes, I am.
You're one of the few guys that hasn't switched to Pro Tools.
Me and Chuck Ainley.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, I always thought Nuendo was a wonderful platform. And I gave up on it, though, because I got tired of constantly, you know, running the battle of, you're not Pro Tools and, you know, the whole thing of having to transfer things all the time was a pain.
Yeah, well, I don't like Pro Tools. You know, I mean, I use it in the studio if I'm in a commercial studio or, you know, if I'm working on somebody's stuff, if I'm overdubbing on a project that's, you know, been started in Pro Tools, you know, I'm not going to switch over. But when I mix, you know, I just get the WAV files and I create my own Nuendo sessions. You know, you got to go with what you feel is right. You know, I was so anti-Pro Tools because I wasn't going to be told what converters I have to use.
Yeah.
What, you know, that was like pissing me off and spending $40,000 on it. I did it the very first time and said, this is bullshit, you know, because I didn't like the way anything sounded. This was back in mid-90s, I guess. And, you know, I just hated it. And at that point in time, I didn't get, you know, I couldn't even get support from them. You know, I'd have questions with it. And, you know, initially on a project that I started, it was the first time I worked in Pro Tools, you know, it kept crashing. And, you know, when I'd call them, you know, I never got a response. To this day, I never got a response. You know, and typically that's what they do. You know, like I did that Eagles documentary film. And we were in Pro Tools, and we had an issue. We were mixing in the box. And, you know, I called Digi, our Avid, and told him what the issue was. I spoke to an engineer, and he said, He said, let me get back to you on this. Never heard from him. Huh. 2 weeks later, he called me back and said, I'm still working on that. 2 weeks later, that was, just, you know, after 2 weeks, he's still working on it.
Yeah, that's not customer service as we know it, that's for sure. It's not any better, I'll tell you.
You know, they created, you know, what is the new platform? If you want to use the record in high def, you have to use their hardware?
Well,
the way it works?
No, not now. Well, maybe you do. You know, I'm not exactly sure. But it depends what you're talking about. High def, is it, you know, 96K or 192? How much do you do in the box these days? Do you do anything in the box, or are you strictly in the console?
Eagles Project was the only thing I've ever done totally in the box. And I hated it. I really didn't. And a good reason for not doing it in the box is there's some deception going on. You know, like, you'll get a plug-in that's supposed to be 96K, and then later find out it's not 96K.
Yeah.
you know, okay. And if you made the mistake of putting it across the output bus at 48K, your 96K files are 48K. And we made that mistake, and we tried to get it onto HD tracks, and they informed us that it wasn't 96K, it was 48K.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember Bob Ludwig telling me that there were some plugins that did just that. You thought that, in fact, they were 96K and they were labeled at 96K, but that's not the way they worked.
Right. I mean, you know, if you're just doing, you know, putting something across a couple of piano tracks, it's not going to affect the overall mix, you know, but putting it across the stereo bus, that's a big problem.
Do you use any of the processing then in Nuendo? Or any plugins?
Yeah, I use the EQ in Nuendo. I really like their EQ, and I've got UAD stuff. I really love that stuff. That's all inside. But you know, I use a lot of stuff outside and on my console,
like reverbs and stuff.
Yeah. I don't use any reverbs in the box.
Yeah. How much fixing and cleanup do you have to do when you get a track in?
Well, occasionally there's a bunch, but I hire my kid to do it. I don't do it. I get too bored.
Yeah. There you go. Easy way out.
My son comes up, he does all the work, or he'll you know, just load it into his laptop and do it there.
How much are you tracking these days?
I have to say, over the course of this last year, maybe 10% was tracking.
Do you miss it?
Yes, I do. I miss going to, you know, commercial studio and seeing people I know, just being able to interact and talk about what's new or what's not new or what we hate, what's shitty about the music business. You know, I miss that whole aspect of it. And I also miss the interaction with musicians. Like, you know, if somebody calls me to do a jazz project, yeah, I don't care what it pays. I'll do it only because it's like 99% I'm going to be in the studio recording musicians in the same room. And I miss that.
Yeah, that's why the Nashville guys have it good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I went down and visited Chuck, and, I mean, he's got a really beautiful analog room. And, I mean, you know, everything he does is, you know, he tracks, you know, and, you know, musicians all live at the same time. It's really, really a great thing.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the problems, I think, with the way we record today is the fact that you can do so much just piecemeal, and everybody chooses to do it that way. And it really takes a lot of the fun out of engineering, that's for sure. It's a lot more fun when you have a lot of people in the room.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any favorite microphones that you always use?
I have a lot of favorites. You know, it depends on what I'm doing. I mean, you know, I love Ribbons. You know, I love Ribbons more now than I ever did. And I love the Royer Ribbons. I love the AT Ribbons. I guess those are my two favorites. I still, you know, when I can, you know, I'll use the old Neumanns 49s. I actually like the Neumann 149s. I'm still fond of certain Shure mics. You know, you can't just, you know, have one or two favorite mics. You got to have a collection. You got to go in there, you know, thinking, you know, you can't use any one thing specifically. And even when you're accustomed to using one thing in one place, all of a sudden that mic is not working in that situation. And you have to be open-minded enough to go to something you might not normally go to.
Yeah. What's your approach to a surround mix? Do you approach it any different than stereo?
Well, in stereo, you got to get everything onto two channels. You know, and surround, you've got a lot of options. Usually if I'm mixing something in surround, 90% of the time I've mixed it in stereo. And so it's easy for me to break it out. You know, I already know the music. I'm familiar with instrumentation. You know, if I'm not, you know, it's an experiment. Like I did Beyonce's album last year in surround. I didn't do any of the stereos. And it was, you know, that was an amazing challenge for me. You know, there were things in there that I never thought I'd ever see, you know. And so it was a lot of fun for me. I mean, it was a great project to work on.
Well, like what? But, you when you say there are things that you never thought you'd see, what? Like what?
A couple of cuts with no bass.
Oh, wow.
You know, all of a sudden you're dealing with a mix that has no bass in it, and it's not just, you know, like a piano and vocal, it's a band or there's instruments. But, you know, what they did, like in a couple of cases, was, you know, an 808 style kick, you know, with some great length to it. And, you know, it substituted for the bass, and it was awesome. It was amazing. It opened up a lot of room, you know, so, you know, it taught me a lot that you don't have to have a bass on everything. And, you know, I thought the way they recorded and produced that record was just brilliant.
Wow. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
So you've seen the music business, at least the modern music business, sort of from its infancy. Where do you think it's going?
I have no idea. It's definitely in a place where people don't make as much money. And I think that anybody who's thinking about getting into the business has to be prepared to, you know, do things a lot differently than we did. You know, it's more, you have to be an entrepreneur and figure out how you're going to make a living. Like for me and my peers, it was, you know, well, I'll get a job at a studio and I'll learn everything and eventually I'll become an engineer, maybe a producer. Number one, there's a few studios that do that. You know, I've seen more studios, like in New York, for example. A lot of studios in Brooklyn have sprung up, and they're really good studios. But the process of, you know, like when I started with Phil, I got paid a weekly salary to learn. That was the way it worked. That doesn't work anymore. You know, they don't hire people and pay them so they can learn how to do this stuff. You know, it's so completely different. You know, a kid may have to, you know, break out on his own and maybe, you know, manage a band or book a band. Or, you know, I tell kids, you know, like engineering students, you know, like at Berkeley or any other place, that, you know, you might want to grab two or three guys, four guys, and try and open up your own room somewhere. You know, put all your resources together and do it that way and share time. You know, I know my son does that. He's got a studio in Brooklyn with three other guys, and they sort of worked it out. So they each have X amount of hours per month, and they can bring in their projects and get paid for it, and they don't have to pay the rest of the guys.
Yeah, it's a good way to do it. Do you see, well, let me put it another way. I see the pot for everybody growing as streaming takes off, because there'll be more places that everybody can get paid from. There'll be more money coming in the business. Do you get that feeling as well?
Not at all.
No.
No, I mean, streaming is how it's going to end up. But, I mean, for example, I remember a couple of years ago, there was a figure running around that in order to earn a minimum wage on Spotify per month, you had to stream 1.3 million plays each month to make minimum wage. That's not very good.
Well, what I tell people about that is the fact that Spotify doesn't have that many paying clients. And really, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that big. So if you look worldwide, there's only 33, 35 million paying streaming customers. And, you know, we get 7 billion people on the planet. So if that goes up to 100,000 or 150,000, all of a sudden there's a lot more money coming in the business than there was before, which seems pretty reasonable.
But they're not going to pay you any more money. I mean, you know, they'll figure some way of cheating you. Everybody does. I mean, record labels cheated us for years. They probably still do. You know, everybody's in business for themselves, you know?
Yeah.
Can't live without the music, but they're not willing to pay for it.
Well, unless there's another product that people have to buy, which, you know, the business would desperately want to have, but I don't see that coming down the pike.
I mean, is, you know, Phonos, you know, Neil Young's thing. I mean, you know, it sounds great, but, you know, people, you know, going to rebuy their catalogs because it sounds better? Not likely.
Yeah, that hasn't worked in the past, has it? People haven't really changed the technology because of quality. They've changed because of convenience that I've seen.
Right. Yeah, it's portability and convenience and, you know, whatever's easiest. And when you introduce a higher quality, you know, kids can hear it. They definitely hear it. They can hear the difference. But it's, so what? I still like the way it sounds, you know, in a low-def
yeah.
version, you know. So it's not important to them. What should be most important is, you know, is earbuds and headphones and how loud everybody's listening. I mean, you know, this generation is going to be pretty deaf by the time they're in their late 40s.
Yeah, I just saw something in the news a couple of days ago about that, where there's fear that 1 billion people were going to actually lose their hearing prematurely.
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
What's it like to work with Steely Dan?
Well, you know, it was always fun. I always had a good time. I'd known these guys forever. And it was fun going to work every day. When you're working, and it applies to anybody, you know, when you're working on a project that you really enjoy, it's fun going to work. You look forward to it. You know, it's not like, oh, shit, I got to go to work again today. It's, I can't wait to get to work today. You know, even when, you know, little was accomplished, you look forward to the next day that, you know, maybe you would accomplish something. You know, the music was great. Playing was always great. You know, songs were great. It was always a great experience, you know, and I worked with, you know, I mean, there's always more than me, usually. You know, it was, you know, Roger Nichols and me, usually, and it was Roger before me, and we had a great time, you know, working together. It was a great experience.
Was it different working with them than many of your other clients in any way?
Well, yeah, you know, because there was so much attention paid to detail, you know. I mean, I remember times when you're recording tracks with a band of maybe 4 to 6, and if one guy made a mistake, you know, we'd start all over, you know, rather than, you know, well, maybe we can edit that piece from another take. It was there in their minds, I think, you know, they wanted everything perfect, and they wanted a band to play a song top to bottom perfectly, you know, which was, you know, which eventually would happen. You know, it was just a question of how much time and money you were willing to devote to it, you know, and it became fun. You know, you know, everybody was like, can we do this? Can we play this perfectly? And a lot of the guys in the band knew, shit, if we don't get this, we're going to be fired tonight. Which was, you know, the case in a lot of situations where they would, you know, fire the whole band and bring in a new band for the next day. But, you know, that didn't stop them from bringing the same band back later. You know, it would be like, well, this particular band can't play this song. So, you know, and it was hard to figure out what was going through their heads, you know, so you just went with it. And it was different than anything I'd ever worked on. I mean, the Eagles were pretty, pretty much into perfection as well, but it was a different thing stylistically, you know, and they could edit and they, you know, they could punch and do stuff. Whereas, you know, Steely would want things perfect top to bottom.
Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea it was like that.
Yeah, it was fun though. I mean, I enjoyed it. You know, everybody enjoyed it. You'd feel a little beat up by the end of the day, and it wasn't anything personal. It was just, you know, the events of the day. But you got to hang with those guys, and you got to hang with, you know, musicians that you'd seen on a daily basis for years, you know. So it was always a lot of fun.
Nice when there's no limitations to the budget, I guess, too.
But that, you know, that was the old days, you know. I don't know how much of that exists anymore, except for really, really big artists. You know, I remember working on albums with people who never made it, who weren't anybody, and spending $500,000 making an album that never did anything. And, you know, that was that. But, you know, there were other things that made up for it on, you know, on the label's roster. So they were always making money, you know?
Yeah. Last question. What's the best piece of music business advice that you've either learned through your time in the business or someone imparted to you?
As an engineer, I learned fairly early on, you know, like most engineers take things personal. And you know, you get hired to do a project, maybe with somebody you don't know. They're hiring you because they liked another record you did, right? And they might even tell you, hey, I really love this record that you did, you know, really want to work with you. And you go in there and you think, well, okay, you know, they like that record, I'm going to do this thing. And, you know, so you spend a few hours working on drum sounds, and then the rest of the band comes in and they listen to the drum sounds. And the artist says, well, no, I don't like this. This kind of sucks. And you take it personally. This guy doesn't like what I do. You know, what kind of bullshit is this? And what I learned is that it's got nothing to do with that. You know, it's an engineer has to remember that he's a hired gun and he's there to solve a problem, not to create one. So when somebody comes in and doesn't like what you do, they say, well, okay, you know, how do you want me to change this? You know, what are you looking for? What kind of thing is it? You know, and try and achieve that rather than taking it personally and saying, get the fuck out of here. You know, and, you know, just that was probably the biggest thing in my life, you know, because it's not your record when it comes down to it. You know, it's not your name on it. It's the artist's name on it. And you've got to make him happy. It's what they want. It's what they want to achieve or a producer wants to achieve, and not what you think you bring to the table. You have to go in there. You're just a soldier. You're a hired gun, and you have to try and achieve what they want to achieve, not what you want to achieve.
How long did it take you to learn that?
It was really early on in my career. You know, it was just a couple of years in. You know, I had a bit, you know, it was Van's record that it was Moondance. You know, I started getting a lot of work based on Moondance. You know, people wanted to work with me. And I remember working with somebody and they hated the drum sound. And I took it really personally, you know, and I don't even remember who put the thought in my head that it wasn't about me, but somebody did. And you know, or maybe it was the artist that did, you know, I hired you for this reason, not for that reason. So it was pretty early on in my career. And I tell that to people all the time, you know, you've got to be more open-minded as an engineer. You know, you're used to doing one thing, but that may not work for everything.
Yeah. It might not even be your fault on a drum sound. It could be the tuning on the drums, the way a drummer's hitting
it. It can be any number of reasons, you know, but it's not a personal thing. They hired you because they like what you do. You know, you just have to do what they need.
One final question. Are you still making baseball bats?
I do as more of a hobby now. I bought a baseball team, and that's my primary thing right now. This is my first year loaning a collegiate summer baseball team. And so I'm not into it. I'm going to make a couple dozen bats for the team, whether they, you know, they might not like them, but, you know, I'm going to make them. And, you know, I don't really care about the bat making business anymore. It was just a stress reliever. You know, I would go in there and not think about anything else but making a baseball bat. Now I've got this baseball team and I'm having fun. You know, that's what I really want to do now is, you know, I mean, aside from the work, the music and stuff, you know, on my off hours, I love dealing with this baseball team thing.
Wow, that's very cool. Is it a local team?
It's in Bristol, Connecticut. It's right near ESPN. And it's, you know, it's all college players that basically, you know, once kids get into a college, after the season's over, they've got nowhere to hone their skills. So there's, you know, the most famous league in the country is the Cape Cod League, where, you know, all these great players go. They go for, you know, a couple of months in the summer, they play baseball, and then they go back to college. So this is the same principle. I have a lease on a stadium in Bristol. It's 100 years old. It was 100 years old last year. And you walk into it, you know, behind home plate, and you take a look around, and it could be 100 years ago because it's in a neighborhood, and you wouldn't know. I mean, the ballpark basically looks the same as it did. It was the place, this ballpark was the place where Babe Ruth hit his very first home run.
Wow.
It's just a really cool, beautiful ballpark. So I'm really into it. I'm having a great time.
Are you a Mets or a Yankees fan?
Well, I grew up a Dodger fan. I guess I'm more of a Mets fan than a Yankees fan, but it's hard to be a Mets fan these days.
I'm a big Phillies fan. I'm about to go to Clearwater next week for spring training.
Oh nice.
I try to go every year, and then when the Phils come out to California, I have a friend out here who's not in the business at all, but he's from Philly, and he and I kind of travel around. We'll go to San Diego, and we'll go to San Francisco, and we'll go to Arizona, and just follow them around for a couple of weeks or a week when they're out here. So that's kind of fun.
We've had a rough couple of years as a Phillies fan.
Yeah, I know. Well, hopefully it'll get better, but not for a couple of years, a couple more years, I think.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Anyway, thanks so much for being with me today, Elliot. It's always great to talk to you.
Yeah, good to hear you, man. Good to catch up with you.
And good luck with your baseball team. It's fascinating. I one day when I come out there, I'll have to come and visit you and the team. That'd be great.
That'd be awesome. We start June 3rd, and we finish up mid-August.
Oh, you're right. It is the summer. The whole summer.
Yeah, so, you know, just, you know, if you're going to be here, let me know, man.
You got it. You got it. Thanks so much, Elliot. I appreciate it.
Okay, great.
Take care.
All right, you too, Bobby.
To find out more about Elliot, go to jdmanagement.com/Elliot Schiner. And Elliot is ELLIOTSCHEINER. Also, if you just Google him or go to Wikipedia, you'll see a whole lot of what he's done, and it's pretty amazing. He has a great portfolio of hits that he's recorded and mixed. Also, Elliot was in the interview section of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, so you might want to check that out as well. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at EDMMR, and he helps put the show together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyointercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com or bobbyointercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts and other things as well. This is Bobby Osinski. See you next time.